very short comment.
I'll open the subcommittee on natural resources for Wednesday, February 21st, 2007, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5530, the Parks and Recreation Department. And here today is Mr. Wood, I believe, with several of his staff members. And oh, there's the Batman list. I feel we're hidden. So,
Mr. Chair, before you start, I have a few comments to make. The department is here to present their budget. This budget has no general funds. All lottery funds in this budget are dedicated to parks and recreation programs and cannot be used in other agency, pretty much other agency budgets other than for the specific purpose that the Constitution allows. And the balance of their budget is made up of other funds and federal funds from user fee supported programs. So with that, I will introduce Tim Wood to start his presentation.
Please start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Wood, Director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and we're here this morning to begin our budget presentation. And just a quick orientation on the book that's before you. We've organized it generally in the way I think that it will be presented. So I would start with the sort of the overview and a little more detail than I provided back in January when we did the 20-minute presentation for you. As Susie pointed out, our budget is revenue stream is laid out on page 1-1 there, and comparison back to 2003-2005, and you'll notice that there is no general fund in our budget. A large portion of our revenue comes from lottery. That's dedicated lottery through Measure 66. Our portion is 7.5% of the dedicated lottery, or 50% of the Measure 66 portion of the lottery that is carved out for parks and for salmon. Just quickly to familiarize you a bit with sort of our revenue structure, we have a beginning balance that we carry forward of about, as you see, the total, the beginning balance there in other funds is made up principally of ATV funds, which are carried over from the previous biennium. We have about $12 million in unexpended ATV funds, and that money comes to us through gas tax, non-refunded gas tax revenue, and from RV permits for registering ATVs. The reason that is so high is when the program came to us in 2000, I think there was a balance of about $6 million that came with the agency. And then you'll notice farther down there that we have about $9.7 million of revenue that will be added to that ending balance related to ATV, and that's, again, ATV registration money as well as non-refunded gas tax that is dedicated by statute to come into that program. Then park user fees make up a significant portion of our other fund budget, about $33 million. You can see that park user fees have generally remained flat over the past several biennia. I'll talk a little bit more about that on a future item here. Interest that we gain through the Treasury, recreational vehicle fees make up another significant portion of our budget. That's revenue which is dedicated to the department, and a portion of that fee for registering an RV, and that's all handled by DMV, is transferred to the department for operational purposes. Additionally, we transfer out a portion of that money to counties. We get 70% of that revenue into our department. 30% goes to counties. So we comes into our department, and then we pass back about 30% of it to counties. And that's basically intended to support operations, development, maintenance of campground facilities that support recreation vehicles. We also get a portion of the salmon plate money. That's remained relatively flat since it was instituted back in about 98, I think. We use those funds to put back into projects in the parks which relate to habitat improvement for salmon, also education related to salmon habitat and the value of salmon to our economy and to our environment. I note there the $9.7 million in all-terrain fuel tax. Then we also receive a transfer from ODOT for basically two purposes. Roads in state parks are considered state highways, so the through roads for major travel are state highways and are eligible for some portion of gas tax. And so we've worked out an arrangement with ODOT, and this is some of our portion of that gas tax that comes back for maintenance and repair of those park roads. Additionally, we do some fee-for-service work for ODOT for maintaining rest areas. They provide us some money, and they designate some of our highway, parks located next to highways as rest areas, and so they reimburse us somewhat for that. And then additionally, we manage 5 ODOT properties as rest areas for ODOT, and that's strictly a fee-for-service arrangement. The next item shows timber revenue, and timber revenue is revenue that's generated from harvested timber on state park properties. The purpose of our timber revenue or our timber harvest program is not to generate revenue, but to manage forests for forest health safety issues. And so this money is generated through thinning projects as well as removal of hazard trees. Also, if there's removal of trees for development of properties or new park properties that we might develop, that revenue is put back into the department through this account. And then the state fair item that's on there shows about $11.6 million in revenue. That's revenue that would be generated through the state fair itself and through other activities that are conducted in the state fairgrounds the other 50 weeks of the year. You'll notice that in 05-07, that number is $6.9 million, and the reason there's a significant difference between those two is because we didn't have the limitation for the full biennium, last biennium, for the fair. So this is the portion of revenue that the fair generated in the 05-07 biennium that is attributable to the time it was a part of the department. So this does that $6.9 million doesn't cover the full last biennium.
Mr. Wood?
Yes.
On that subject, if we did have the full amount being reflected in that first number, would the fair be showing a net increase in revenue or still?
Mr. Chair, it would show a net increase in revenue from last biennium to the coming biennium.
In terms of if we reflected all the revenue from the previous biennium in your budget?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Yes.
On that same subject, I remember burdening you with the state fair in the last session. I opposed that, but just to add a comment that you're doing remarkably well with an entity that had been continuously losing money, and so you're to be congratulated on righting that at least temporarily.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grard, I'd like to attribute a lot of that success to the fair manager, Dave Kohlermeyer, who was back here as well, so you'll hear from him sometime during our presentation.
Mr. Wood, I don't want to give you any trepidation, but my guess is that, with the exception of Representative Clem, who wasn't here, all three of the legislators that are before you now, other than Representative Clem, opposed.
Representative Clem's from Salem, Mr.
Mr. Please, Chair, I'd just point out that it wasn't our bill that was presented. Then at the bottom of the page there, you'll show that our total other funds are $137 million. Federal funds are transfers that we get from the federal government for various grant programs and for some money into our Heritage Program Division. And then It shows the reduction of our revenue by $10.6 million for pass-through of the ATV the RV money back to counties, and then other transfers, which are a portion of that ATV tax money, which goes back to snowmobilers, and it's also a transfer to just transfer funds within accounts within the department. So our total revenue picture for 07-09 is $229,654,000. And on the right side, you can see the pie chart of kind of how it's broken out as a percentage, how the various revenue sources are broken out as a percentage of the total revenue picture for the department. You'll note the lottery continues to grow in our budget and now makes up about approximately 44% of our total revenue picture. The next page talks to expenditures, and down the left-hand column, we have our expenditures broken out by decision unit in our budget. Operations is the portion of the department that operates our parks in the field. It's the largest portion, organizational unit within the department. So all our park rangers, park operations, as well as our beach safety program, land acquisition, except for the money that goes into land acquisition, property management, I guess, would be better. Our forestry and natural resource management is all part of operations. Our facility investment program, the acquisitions program, and the grant program, those decision units that are shown there, were actually three decision units that were added to our budget in 99-01 after the passage of Measure 66. So those three decision units and programs are there principally to address the reduction in backlog and repair and maintenance in facilities and the development of new park properties and enhancing existing ones, acquisitions for acquiring more park lands, and then the grants program, which is principally local grants that go out to communities and also grants that go to heritage providers as well. So that's those are the decision units in our budget. Under acquisitions, you'll note that we have a request for an acquisition program of $11 million. In 1999-01, the first budget, the first year that the lottery money was made available to us, our acquisition program was $4 million. And in the current biennium, it's $7.5 million, and we're looking to take it to $11 million. And when we talk about key performance measures, I can give you a little more details on kind of what effect that might have. Heritage programs are basically the management of our heritage responsibilities that we have in the department. I am designated as the State Historic Preservation Officer, and so in that role, the agency has responsibilities for management of the National Historic Preservation Act in the department, which includes the management of the properties which are put on the National Register of Historic Places and other state programs. The state archaeology program is all managed through there as well. And our responsibilities in meeting the state's responsibilities for meeting federal requirements under those programs. Recreation programs is a new decision unit in this budget. We've had these functions before, but we had them broken out elsewhere in the department. Recreation programs manages what we call partnerships and outreach with other park and recreation providers. They also manage our interpretive program, our volunteer program, which is have on order of about 221 FTE worth of volunteers in our system every year. So hosts, folks who help with maintenance, who do program activities as well, they're all included in our volunteer program, which is in the Recreation Programs Division. And we also have 15, I believe, friends groups associated with the department, like the Friends of Historic Shampooey, the Friends of Vista House, volunteer groups who help us keep those properties open and put on programs to make them available to the public. So they basically augment staff. What else in recreation programs is also our planning section, where we do all our master planning for parks, planning that we do in conjunction with other partners. The grants program I mentioned, the state fair budget you can see is $14.2 million. That's budget. You'll also notice that we have $4.2 million in debt service that goes with the fair. And there are a series of, I believe, four bonds which go out to about 2019 before all those bonds are retired. So I think that's correct. And there are, and it's about right now, about $19 million worth of debt. In the current biennium, the department, I was waiting for a chance to use this word, the department defeased a bond that we took out in 97-99, a $15 million lottery-backed bond to begin our facility investment program. And so we paid that off with revenue generated through the lottery in the current biennium. One of the things we might look at in the future is there a time when, you know, this debt ought to be paid off? But we have a business plan for the state fair that's going to help us. Our goal is to retire the debt through the operation business plan that we're putting together. So at some point we may be talking about trying to retire that debt if that's the appropriate thing to do. But right now we have about $14 million in expenditures at plus $4.2 million in debt service. And then the administration decision unit is comprised of our financial services section, personnel, our reservations Northwest, our automated reservation system, the director's office. Basically, the organization provides the business support services to the department. Although that adds up to about 11% of the total budget, really reservations Northwest piece is really sort of an operational function, but for the purposes of accounting, we manage it through our information services section out of administration. So that's basically what our recommended budget is for 2007-2009. And so we're asking for expenditures in the amount of $212.6 million. And you can see by the pie chart there on the right how it's broken out in terms of what percentage of each of those programs is as a percent of the total expenditure. The budget includes an increase of 18 positions and 28.58 FTE. And that'll come out as we talk about program option packages in the future. So that would take our FTE from 570.75 in the current biennium to 599.33 in the next biennium.
Mr. Wood, going to the grants, and these are obviously probably grants to counties, cities, and parks, special districts, I would guess. Do we have a breakdown in those grants of how much actually goes to acquisitions, how much goes to other capital improvements, and I don't know if we allow those grants to be used for recreational purposes in terms of operating.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that with me, but we can provide that. The local grant program provides funds for acquisition, provides funds for rehabilitation and development of new facilities, but it does not include funds for operations and maintenance or program dollars. One of our program option packages, the youth grant program, we will be talking to you about later. We're asking for limitation and authorization to establish a grant program to assist in local park and recreation providers and nonprofit groups to engage in activities that get kids outdoors and active. But that also does not include maintenance money or operations money. You know, principally, if another recreation provider is coming asking for grant money, you know, there's match required in all of our grant programs. So that shows the local commitment. But also, even coming forward and asking for that, the local applicant has to acknowledge and take on the responsibility for operations and maintenance of that facility over time. So that doesn't end up being sort of a burden, if you will, to the state in that regard.
If I could get that breakdown, it'd be helpful.
Sure, we can get that for you.
And in your long-term plan for the state fair, going away from the debt service. But is there a point at which you believe that the revenues will equal the expenditures?
Mr. Chair, we have a business plan in place, not counting the debt service. We're striving to get to at least break even in 5 years, so the revenue will equal expenditures.
Any questions from the committee? Yes.
Is that business plan in the information that you're giving us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girardi, it's not, but we can provide that to you.
I would like to have it. Thank you.
Will do.
Representative Clem, and then Representative Dingfeld, do you have a question?
All right. I have a follow-up. But
that's a different topic if you want to.
Well, Mr. Chair, the other is the long-term plan for paying off the debt service, and I don't know if that's in the state current operations plan, but I think we need to at some point make a decision point about both the debt service and, you know, how long we're going to subsidize the state fair at some point. I mean, I was looking over the discussions from last session, and as Mr. Chair already mentioned, several of us had a lot of concerns about having you guys saddle with the state fair. I think at some point we need to say, okay, the legislature's got to make a decision on how long we're going to subsidize it. So same thing with the debt service, because we want to have the debt service going on forever as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, clearly our business plan is laid out to make this fair operation, as I said, at least break even. We have a consideration in our business plan that if at some point, in about 5 years from now, we can't get to that point, then there needs to be some policy decisions made with regard to whether we continue to operate it as we are, whether we move it to a different department, whether we change the structure of it. But our business plan will get us to a point where we will have to address the question. If it's not profitable or break even, then it will put the question back on the table. With regard to the debt service, we really haven't made any decisions about, you know, addressing the debt service yet. Frankly, we're learning a lot about the fair and its operation on a day-to-day basis. So, as we haven't come back to the session this time with any legislative changes to statute, which we might do in the next session, you know, to allow some other discretionary authority and, you know, in managing the fair. But that's because we're still trying to figure out what it is we're managing here.
Just a clarification. As far as the debt service, since it's listed under lottery, so that's Measure 66.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder,
well.
That's correct. I believe the last by any means, it was lottery, but it was came from non-dedicated lottery sources, I believe. No, you know.
66 as well last time. So this is a continuation.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm one behind. Prior to that.
Right. Okay, so this is a continuation of using Measure 66 money to pay off the debt service for the state fair.
That's correct. Okay.
Representative Klein.
Mr. Chair, and actually this may end up being a question for you. On the recreational fee receipts, I guess, that come in from the fee, which is set through Department of Motor Vehicles, I guess, budget, not here. If we have questions or interests around that, is it the actual fee amount? Is that really more appropriate for that budget? Because here there is no discussion of the amount. It's just whatever the amount is, that's what they end up getting.
I think, well, the analyst is right. It's a policy question, and the recreational vehicle fees are set as a matter of policy. I don't think they've been adjusted.
They were adjusted last session.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any discussion of adjusting them again in this session.
Not the fee itself, no.
No.
So, Paul, Mr. Chair, so I have a bill that will do something on the fees. That would end up being referred. Where do you think, if it made it out of a policy committee?
Maybe here.
Maybe here, but maybe transportation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it may not get referred to Ways and Means unless there is a fiscal impact that affects one of the agency's budgets within the bill. The policy committee could adopt a fee increase or some other distribution of how those fees are allocated without having to come to Ways and Means, unless it has some impact on the budget itself.
I had one other question on a different topic, but I could wait.
Well, please go. Ask a question.
This is the historic properties function, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I wondered if you could just sort of make a note that on the state hospital grounds now, there are, I know, applications in to make some of the buildings on the National Register. And then also, depending on what happens there, the properties that are there, you know, again, depending on whether they get on the National Register or not, are of interest to myself and my neighbors around there, the constituents around there. Also, the green space that's there, in effect, is something that is almost park-like, although I know it's not a park, but in terms of if we end up having to move that property elsewhere, what happens there is of interest, great interest to my district, and would like to have your involvement in that, because right now I don't know that Parks is at the table for what happens to that property.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, I don't know that we are either, other than our role in reviewing applications for the National Register at this point.
Representative Garrard.
Tim, with the growing budget problems of counties, does state statute permit the counties to return county parks to state jurisdiction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I don't know that it addresses it specifically, but if I think there's latitude within the statutes to transfer that property or to work cooperatively in a management agreement. So I don't know that the statute addresses it specifically, but I think it's well within our authority to be able to do that.
I would say, Mr. Wood, it's been my experience that the average Oregonian, when they go to a large park facility, they really do not know if it's a county facility or a state facility. Some counties have some very large facilities, and I just think it's kind of interesting that you know, the public just sees it as a park. That's basically what it comes down to. I did want to say something about the debt service. Having been here when the debt service was incurred, in fairness, the debt service came about, in my understanding and the discussions we had here at that time, because there was a belief that the state fair was not viable without major improvements. And the legislature, with probably very little dissent, actually approved that debt service because the case was made to them that it would not remain viable without making the investments in the facilities. So the debt service really isn't, I mean, we can't just attribute it to the state fair. This body made the decision to go into debt, and I think with actually very little dissent, if my memory is correct. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. No additional questions, please proceed.
Right. On page 1-3, I won't talk to this in any great detail, but this is just a breakout by fund source of how we fund the various decision units. The only comment that I would make is with regard to operations. So you'll sort of our operational scheme, if you will, or our financing scheme has always been, since we got dedicated lottery money, to try our best to support park operations, sort of our bread and butter of our operations, with user fees, and then augment that with lottery funds. And so that's what you see there. I'll talk to that in a little more detail when we get to talking about 2% efficiencies and how that kind of breaks out. But, you know, if we go back to pre-Measure 66 in 97, 99, there was a portion of our funding which came from general fund, which basically augmented field operations, and so that's continued with lottery money here. So unless you have any questions on sort of the fund source,
Please proceed.
The next page, 1-4, talks about what affects our budget. In many ways, we've talked about this already, but again, the park user fees come to us from the day-to-day operations of the parks. That includes the 27 day-use fee parks that we operate across the state and the revenue that we generate through camping and overnight facilities around the state. And then, obviously, as I just mentioned, we use lottery funds to augment the operational costs, but also lottery funds are used to fund three principal programs which weren't there before Measure 66, and that's our acquisition program, grants to local communities, and then work to eliminate the backlog of maintenance and repair. I mentioned earlier, and you can note in the graph to the right, that park user fees, park visitor fees, have generally remained flat over time. We haven't had a fee increase in the department in over 10 years. We felt that because we've had the augmentation with lottery money, we didn't need to raise the fees. But the only changes or adjustments that we've made to fees have been to accommodate local lodging taxes that we also have to pay for those campgrounds. And then our federal funding has increased since about 99, when they reinstituted payments through the Land and Water Conservation Fund and through funding for heritage programs, but that's up and down. And so we're looking at somewhat of a decrease in federal funds in the coming biennium as a result of changes to the federal budget. Certainly, you know, growth in lottery is the big story on this chart. In 99-01, we began with the dedicated Measure 66 funding of about, if I remember correctly, about $41 or $42 million. And you can see that today, in 2007 and 2009, we're more than double that in revenue from lottery. I think that's attributable to the addition of line games and some changes in commissions and some other things that have gone on, you know, in managing lottery that has caused this to increase. I recall in 99-01 when we started the lottery funding that folks were saying, you know, don't get used to $40 million because the lottery's never going to be there again, and it's done nothing but increase since that time. But I can't help believe at some point it's got to at least flatten out. But at least recently, the gains are attributable, I think, to the additional line games and the changes in the commissions.
Mr. Chair? Yeah. Just on that point, do your sort of projections assume it might flatten out in this next two-year period, or is everything based on it continuing to grow at a certain pace?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, our projections are based on the projections that the lottery department provides, and it shows some continued growth yet. So, and then what has happened is the growth has always exceeded projections. So we've ended up with more lottery money projected as revenue during the biennium than we actually had at the time we had a legislatively approved budget. So I say, it's not a bad problem to have, but
Representative Clem, during our 8 quarters of declining income tax revenue, our lottery revenue increased every quarter. It's part of the forecast that we get every quarter. It's very robust. It's as indicated probably in one of our earlier meetings, it's the revenue that we bond on that we get the highest bonding rating. I don't think that I would agree with Mr. Wood that sooner or later you would think it would start to flatten out, but that hasn't happened thus far.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered, you know, if it does, for example, I think we talked about 28 new FTE within 19 positions. You know, if it just for some reason happened, do we have the ability, is it scalable? Do we have the ability to pull back on things we're doing without massive pain? Are we creating an infrastructure that couldn't deal with it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, that's a good question. As we add staff, mostly to our field operations, they're generally related to some sort of revenue a link to park user fee revenue. So that's not to say that, you know, all those expenses would be covered by revenue generated at that park, but there's somewhat of an offset there. But if we got to the point where we had expenditures that were in excess of what our lottery revenue was, or our total revenue was, we'd have to make some changes to some of our program ideas, such as changes to the local grants program, reduction of acquisitions, partnerships with other agencies. We really haven't made any specific recommendations about how we would do that, but those are the kinds of expenditure reduction actions that we would need to consider to bring things in line.
Representative Berard, then Senator Nelson.
Just a quick comment. We probably need an education program to get into our schools to teach our kids to gamble at an earlier age so that we can sustain this continued increase.
With that,
that would be a policy bill.
Senator Nelson.
Yes. Do you have any sort of percentage limitations? So much has to be in capital expenditures like OEM or anything like that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, no. Our lottery revenue can be used for a host of uses, and it's not sort of compartmentalized at percentages.
We have a question, actually.
I just asked, what happened to the Historical Society?
It's
funding.
Within your heritage funding, is it not? In your
yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, we have a program option package for in this budget for $2.8 million, and I understand that it will be heard as a separate bill and won't be included in our budget discussions, but I don't know if it's adopted how it might be funded.
Benny?
It is currently being negotiated which committee it will probably be in.
And the funding for that policy option package is?
I'm sorry.
60.
I didn't
is it
hear.
A source of funding for that policy option package?
It would be lottery.
To measure 66 million.
Yes.
Representative Dingfelder, I believe there are outstanding questions about the level of the funding. There are questions about, I have to be careful putting this on the record, about whether it fits within the constitutional definition of those expenditures. But I think a lot of those issues are going to be debated, and we may or may not see a bill. Is that a fair statement?
That's fair.
Mr. Chair, when do we include the Pelton Roundup? I'm just kidding.
Excellent question there. Could be a recreation activity.
Yeah, but I think
things on the coast.
Unfortunately, Senator Nelson, I think you could probably make a heritage case for the Pendleton Roundup also. Well, with that, we will. Should we go through the? Do you have any more on budget drivers? Or?
Mr. Chair, no, I really don't. You know, park use is sort of limited by a few things. It's limited principally by weather and availability of leisure time. Those are two of the greatest factors. Gas prices seem to have some effect, but not a whole lot. And sometimes gas prices have the reverse effect that you would think, because people stay at home and they visit parks more than they would. But that's also limited by the capacity that we have to be able to handle them. And you know, our summertime camp ground capacity is very high, and so there's not a whole lot of flux capacity in there to be able to accommodate a whole lot of increase.
I do have one final question regarding that is a budget driver regarding our fees. And I'm not sure if this would be an interstate commerce issue or not, but do we have the capability to look at a tiered fee structure where you have different fees for in-state versus out-of-state residents? Given we don't have a sales tax here. A lot of states, the way that they capture additional revenue is through their sales tax. So is that something you've looked at? I don't know what the constitutionality of that.
Representative Dingfelder, commenting on that, Mr. Wood, would I kind of know the history of this. Could you comment on what happened when you attempted to do that, not you personally, but when state parks attempted to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, Senator Devlin points out, this was way before my time, but there have been several discussions or, I guess, questions raised about changing, doing a fee structure that would charge more for out-of-state than in-state residents. And I think what Senator Devlin's referring to is, I don't know, 15 or 20 years ago, the department attempted to do that, and they ended up with a drastic sort of drop-off in use and a retaliation, if you will, by other states, you know, who then would charge Oregonians more, who, you know, than they would charge local residents. And my understanding of sort of this issue across state park systems across the nation is that's what other states have found, that if they've they've increased fees for out-of-state folks, then there's retribution from neighboring states the same way, and use drops off. I think the important consideration here is camping and park use is linked to tourism, which is really a local economic development issue, and regardless of whether somebody comes from California, Washington, or Ohio, there's a great benefit to the local community that, as those dollars are spent and filtered through the local economy, without regard to what state they're from. But
well, as a follow-up to that, I'll ask this question. I think it was two sessions ago when the tourism tax passed. Is that correct? Was it two or three?
I'd have to look that up.
Two.
1%
tourism. We adjusted it last session. And
okay. And maybe this is a question for Susie. Was there any discussion about including having a percentage of that tourism tax go either to state parks or to local jurisdictions for their park maintenance? Because since parks are such an integral part of our tourism infrastructure, I don't ever recall that discussion when we debated the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I don't believe so either. I don't know.
Something you need to?
City's water.
If I might clarify one issue, Mr. Woods, in that 1 cent that we adopted that went to tourism.
1%.
1%, yeah. Where you have parks that are within a jurisdiction that actually has a lodging tax, and you have a facility that would be, well, a yurt, or you have a cabin. Do you pay the local lodging tax also?
Mr. Chair, we do. In jurisdictions that charge lodging taxes, unless they've specifically exempted us, we pay that tax as well.
Representative Plin.
Chair, to Representative Dingfelder's question, do we have a lot of waiting lists for people to get into state parks? I mean, that's why I wonder about the usage drops off. The theory would be that Californians would be replaced by Oregonians who can't get in, but is that just not the reality that we have backlogs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, to some degree that's probably true. It's one for one competition for the available sites, and we do them on first come, first serve basis.
Try to get into Brookings.
And it probably varies by park too, I would guess, right, whether or not there's huge, competition on the opening day, everybody floods it or not.
Reservation system also.
On a personal note, my sister from Bakersfield, who actually goes to state parks in Oregon literally every year, gets on the online system as soon as it opens up to start making her reservations. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, we have sort of a tiered or structured system in our parks. We have parks which we call destination parks, and they're sort of the high use, highly sought after locations with big campgrounds, places like Fort Stevens, Honeyman, Sunset, Brookings, Harris Beach, Silver Falls, which are destination parks. And then we have a series of parks we call, and most of those are managed under our reservation system. And then we have another series of parks that we call what do we call them there? I just had this conversation. What's that? Value Park. Yes. So they are sort of a lesser or lower level of service, if you will, in terms of amenities. And those, so the competition in the destination parks for space available is always very high, but it's lesser at value parks. And so what we try to do when folks try to make reservations and they can't get into one of the larger parks is we refer them to other parks in our system. And then we also have a tiered fee system such that you pay slightly less at a value park, and then we have a rate structure that is basically May through Labor Day, when we call that prime season. That's our high use time. There's one rate structure for that, and then we have the rest of the year, which is we call discovery season, and all the rates at all those locations are $4 less than they are during prime season. So we have some ways that we try to encourage folks to, you know, make use of what's available, and as well try to provide, you know, a fee structure that can address economic situations of individuals as well.
Follow up, and then we'll get on to the.
I just might be interested in pursuing this a little further in the way that the ODF&W does, where rather than, well, they have differential fees as well. Well, you don't have differential fees. They do have differential fees, but even if they didn't have differential fees, they have sort of caps where up there no more than 5% of the population of users of hunting tags in this case are going to be from out of state, and once they hit 5%, then pretty much all the rest go to in-state. And that might be a way to go about it where it wouldn't spark retaliatory things nor fee. Well, I don't know if it's about that, but it wouldn't lose fees. It would only be used if there were high demand. I'm thinking out loud. I'll stop doing that. But
well, your choices at this point, Representative Clem, would be to use one of your priority bills. Because that clearly is a policy issue. And
oh, is it? All right, thank you,
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment. Although the issue of a different fee structure for residents versus non-residents comes up every year from our visitors, it doesn't occur to me that it's a big issue with folks. I mean, it isn't like it's there's a big hue and cry out there amongst Oregonians, that they ought to be, collectively, they ought to be paying less, and we ought to charge out-of-state folks. So that's just my observation, if you will. There are always proponents for charging more for out-of-state folks, and people can logically make an argument to do that. But I think it's also, we need to consider the reciprocity, I guess, that Oregonians enjoy in other states as well.
So. One thing, Mr. Chair, that would be helpful, I think, in this discussion also, could you or your staff provide for us a comparison of state park fees, maybe from our surrounding states? Because I don't know how our fees rate in relation to, I go to California and Washington parks, but I can't recall exactly what we pay. So, and Idaho and Montana, but it might be interesting for us to see, and if any of those states do charge a differential.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkfelder, we'll do that for you.
Not to pursue this policy discussion, but the other issue that you might face is if we had a downturn in usage of those parks, not only would it be a downturn in the revenue to state parks that comes from operations, it might impact those communities that depend upon that tourism, for their local economies. So it has a lot of ramifications. So I guess we will go on now to policy packages, and I think we'll follow the same practice we had before. We'll go two at a time, and then I'll take questions after each two that you do. So. I'm sorry, I said policy packages. I meant performance measures.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next section does talk to the 15 performance measures that we have adopted or have been adopted by the department, and they measure a range of performance and program performance across the department. I think we've made considerable improvement in these performance measures, but we need to keep working at them. And with your feedback and feedback of others and some additional work that we'll do in the department, we're going to work over the next biennium or so to continue to improve these. But the first performance measure is the first two performance measures are related to grants, and these two measures relate to how we provide service to our customers who are grant applicants and grant receivers, if you will. So the first measure looks at the percent of all qualified local recreation and heritage grants that are funded. And what we're trying to use here is get an indicator of, you know, are we getting more qualified applications than we're able to support, and generally that's a question of funding. So that can help us make decisions about whether we should put more revenue into our grant program so that we can meet a higher percentage of what the demand is. Sort of a history of our local grant program here. We started with $5 million in 1901 when we created this under Measure 66. We have $10 million in the local grant program in this biennium. We had $9 million in the current biennium, and we're looking at a policy option package to increase that to $10 million. And frankly, right now, we're getting more qualified applications than we can fill. So it gives us an indication, a decision point, if you will, about how we allocate available lottery money for funding. So over the life of this program, we put about $25 million in 140 different communities and various grant programs. So this is very important to us and is very important to our providers. So that's principally what that measures, is our ability to, based on the funding available, to meet the local grants requirements. The second performance measure is more of a measure of how that program is managed and executed, if you will. You know, we have two-year biennial money here, so our goal is to get the money, get the grants awarded, the money in the hands of the local providers, get the project on the ground so folks can get the benefit of it, and get the project closed out as quickly as possible. And we've identified that as a goal of 730 days. So already in this biennium, we're gearing up to do the review for projects, which hopefully will be funded through the grants program in the coming biennium, so that we can kick that off very early in the biennium and get the money in the hands of the local providers so they can get the projects on the ground.
You're into this. Go ahead.
Well, can you explain what fully executed means? Does that mean that they have, if they need permits to do work, that they have their permits in hand? Does this mean that they have gone through the Park Service process and they have a check in their hand and then they can start implementing the project? So I guess clarification.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, what this means is the project is complete. So when they come in and make application, their application, you know, has to demonstrate that they've done considerable amount of preparatory work, so that once they get the check, they'll be able to execute the project complete it within 730 days.
Just a follow-up to that, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little perplexed about this, because some of this is going to be out of your control. I mean, if it was, you know, processing grant applications and turning those around within 120 days, I guess I'm a little confused about, you know, if there's an extensive, say, restoration project, I mean, that permitting process could take a long time. They may have to wait a whole year for an in-stream work period. I mean, some of this is going to be out of your control. So, and I'm curious how you came up with the 730 days also. I mean, was that an average of what you were seeing in the past?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, the measure recognizes the fact that there will be some projects, because of weather, problems with contractors or whatever, that will preclude every project from meeting that goal. It could be permitting, it could be, you know, contracting issues or whatever. So we wouldn't expect that every project would meet this goal. So there are some some provisions in here to allow for that. I mean, we have the same issues on projects that we execute ourselves. And the 730 days is, what is that, 367? That's almost the two-year period of time. Yeah, and that's the reason that, because our money, what we don't want to do is get in a position where we have a lot of unexpended money that we carry over from biennium to biennium in projects that because they haven't been executed. So that's why we chose the 730 days, or essentially the two-year
and I think that's, time frame. That's also the reason you withhold the final 10% too.
Yes. We work very closely with our grant applicants in developing this measure. We've discussed it with folks who are grant applicants. What we want to do on our side is be sure that we don't have internal processes that are keeping them from getting projects held up. So it's not just a question of how do our grant applicants perform. It's a question of how we perform internally as well, and what processes do we have in place to help the local applicant expedite their process and get the project on the ground. This is a new measure in this biennium.
Any additional questions on performance measures 1 or 2? Okay.
How much of the, issue is funding and availability, which is more a function of whether people are gambling or not, or the legislature is appropriating or not, but not the agency?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, it's really a question, assuming that there's revenue there, is more of a question of how our commission makes a policy decision about how they'll allocate those resources, against other competing programs, whether it's acquisitions or operations or whatever. And so it provides an indicator to them of what the need is and how well we're meeting that need, which is information they can use as they develop policy option packages for future budgets.
Additional questions on 1 or 2? Seeing none, let's go on to 3 and 4.
Key performance measure number 3, percent of Oregonians who believe that Oregon is doing a very or somewhat good job of providing parks and natural areas and preserving Oregon's heritage. This is a measure we've been doing for some time. We get the data from this through the survey that's conducted biannually by the Oregon Progress Board, and the results have been very consistent, and we've been in the high 90s, in the 90s to mid-90s, in terms of meeting, doing somewhat good or very good job of meeting these needs. Frankly, I think this is one of the most significant performance measures we have. It isn't an output kind of measure, if you will, but it's really an indication of the equity that our agency has in the customers that it serves. And, all these other measures withstanding, I think the question of customer satisfaction sort of transcends all of those. So you'll see in this performance measure, we have a whole series of our program option packages that are linked in many ways to this performance measure. That's one that we think is very significant.
Chair?
Yes.
Question?
Yes.
Tim, why does your target go down in customer satisfaction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, the what you see in 2004 and earlier are actual results, and in 2006 and 8, those are the results in 2004 and earlier. How do I say this? Are within the margin of error that occurs within for 2006 and 2008. So the margin of error is really 4% on this survey. So we would expect to see 90% or better if we're in the margin of error. So I guess that's the low end of the range that we might expect to get and maintain our current level of service. I explained that very well, didn't I?
I'm still trying to figure that out.
I think what you're basically saying, if I might,
should have been 90% the whole time.
Mr. Wood, is you're saying that they're querying park users in one manner or another the margin of error is 4%. So at 90%, you'd be in a range between 94 and 86.
That's correct.
If they say 90, it might be the equivalent of 94, and it might be the equivalent of 86.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, I think his point, though, is that in 2000, 2002, and 2004, those probably should then also read 90% plus, and then whatever they ended up being. Because I don't see how it could be 91 actual and also 94 actual, which is, I think, what the verbal description implied.
We can clarify that further, actually.
But Mr. Chair, and the other is, don't we want to have targets where, I mean, I understand there's a margin of error, but this is a target, so you could say 90, 91, 92, saying we want to actually increase customer satisfaction over time because of improvements in, you know, reducing the backlog, or that we're adding additional parks or improving our parks. I mean, I think that's the whole point of having a target, is that we want to aim for increasing, I would imagine, customer satisfaction if that's what we're trying to measure here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, that's correct. You know, I mean, we could get it as high as 96%. There will always be, you know, a portion of folks who respond in a survey.
But maybe we do that, and then we say we've reached what we think is, because, I mean, we are investing a lot in parks right now, and especially in reducing the backlog of maintenance, and hopefully that will make a difference if our restrooms are in better shape, or, you know, the reservation system is more efficient. Or, I mean, I think that's the whole part of having targets, that we do. I mean, we're already doing it. You guys are doing a great job. If we can do better, we should aim for that. That's sort of my understanding why we have performance measures. Is also, I mean, we don't want to make the targets unrealistic. However, if we can do better, and when we think that there's improvements over time that will improve the state park system, we should look at that.
We can relook at that one.
A follow-up to that, Mr. Wood, would be, is does the survey give you any information on why some people might rate their experience lower?
Mr. Chair, no. This survey is of Oregonians, not necessarily park users. Later on, we have, I think it's number 12, we have a performance measure which deals specifically with park users, and that one does drill down to issues of, you know, if you're not satisfied, why are you not satisfied?
We will go on to D then, if there are no additional questions, and we'll try to do D and E before we have any more questions. So,
performance measure 4 is just a measure of the number of Oregonians that visit Oregon State Parks. And you can see that there are several issues that are involved here. One is, you know, are we able to grow visitation usage because we're growing in population as well. So part of the growth in visitation is projecting increased visitation as a result of increased growth or increased population in the state. And it's also somewhat limited by capacity issues in terms of, if you're talking about camping, you know, this is a combination of camping and day use numbers here. If you're talking about camping and camping is limited, you know, then that also has an impact on our ability here. And we can use that information to decide about acquiring more properties, what types of properties to buy, as well as, you know, what types of amenities that we should be providing. Item E, performance measure number 5, is a measure of this measure is intended to measure performance of our heritage programs. One of our responsibilities is to preserve the state's heritage, its historic resources. And so this is a measure of how well we are using our heritage programs to protect properties. That could be through the National Register Program. That could be properties under protection, if you will, preservation encouraged under the special assessment program for property taxes. It could be heritage grants that we provide to local businesses or individuals. So it's a whole host of programs that we use, and basically what we're trying to do in our heritage program is to become more of an outreach organization, to find ways to help people preserve and protect their properties, whereas in the past we've kind of been more of a regulatory role. So that's what this measure is intended to measure. The big difference in 2005 to 2006 is noted there, because prior to 2005 we didn't count the properties which are under the tax special assessment program, and frankly they are that is a measure of protection that we should be including in our measurement here.
Any questions on 4 and 5?
Sure, I had a question.
Yes.
Well, again, and I know you did that. These are performance measures that were set last session or two sessions ago.
Last session.
I guess again, I'm a little perplexed with performance measure D, because here's what I'm trying to figure out. And I was reading through your information, and I can't find it in here as far as. And I thought that we had a benchmark that talked about the acreage of or of parkland per. Where we have a ratio per Oregon resident to look at meeting the needs of Oregon citizens.
That's measure six.
Okay.
Measure
so six. What I was trying to figure out, I guess D didn't really tell me that much except for, are you getting more visitors? And I guess I wanted to, as far as measure six tells us a lot more, I guess I'm just perplexed about what this actually tells us, except for whether you're getting more visitors or not overall in all the state parks. But I mean, and to me, that's not necessarily a performance measure. It's just information. I mean, to me, a performance measure would be we're going to increase visitation levels or increase access to state parks for certain populations. I guess maybe Susie can explain the rationale behind that from last session.
Mr. Wood, if
not
you
off
want.
The top of my head, to
share. Yeah. And I apologize because I probably sat in that discussion. I'm just
Madam Chair, Representative Dingfelder, this is not just a new performance measure. We've had this one for some time, but you're correct in that it reflects, you know, whether our visitation trends are online or not. But the way we would use this information is to help us make decisions about, you know, are we meeting capacity? Are we meeting need? You know, as much as as the population is growing and we're getting, you know, more people into parks, there's sort of a changing trend in how people are using parks. And so are we, you know, managing our facilities or developing our facilities for the future in a way that will meet the needs of the growing population. And so, while the number itself, I guess that it would be an indicator, it would be a poor indicator if the numbers were down and population trend was up. How critical, you know, this particular performance measure is, I don't know. It's an indicator, if you will, of
well,
trend.
I mean, that's just, it's more of an indicator than really a performance measure, because I don't understand. I mean, are we measuring whether we're adequately meeting the needs of a growing population? Or I guess that's what I'm trying to really figure out. And I definitely see number six as, I think, a key indicator of, or key performance measure for that. But I guess
Representative Dingfelder, I would think part of it would be, if you looked historically, is there has always been a tie, at least in a lot of discussions in this building over several decades, of state parks, number of visits, to connection with tourism. And tourism for a number of years has been considered a leading state industry. And so that the more visitors that state parks brings into the state, the more that state parks are used, the better it has been thought for the economy. Now, it doesn't really measure whether or not the state parks facilities have adequate space. And I think measure six might be more focused in that area than this measure, but I think there has been always an interest in how much use there was of state park facilities.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I have a quick comment to make. The agency did appear before the Joint Legislative Audit Committee during the interim for a review of a few of their measures that the legislature had sent them there for. And one of the things that the Parks Commission came back with after that review was an indication that they felt they needed to take a further look at their performance measures because they didn't feel that they adequately covered the performance of the parks. And so the the department made a commitment to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee that they would be taking some time during this next interim to take another look at their performance measures and may have some suggestions. And this may be one that we want to target as one for them to review.
And just to follow up in this is not... This could be repeat visitors, too. In other words, it's just the visits.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, it measures visits or camper nights. So it could be the same camper for multiple nights.
Representative Clem, and then I have a question.
The only thing I could think of that might help, Mr. Chair, on this get to, if you had as a percentage of overall population growth number of visits, then you would know that the population was going up 3%, but the visits only went up 1%, and we know for some reason we're not, you know, the parks aren't set up in a way that accommodates the same percentage of people moving here aren't wanting to go to the park. And then you know you need to do something differently, you know, public outreach or something.
Of course, then there would be other variables, too, because you're not talking simply about the population of Oregon, because a large portion of this is going to be people visiting the state.
I had a budget note to stop population growth. I don't know if that's something you'd entertain or not.
With that, Mr. Wood, I did have a question about your role in heritage programs and, in a sense, the state official who's responsible for heritage programs. I have seen this in some places in state parks. As you well know, having worked in state parks, the National Park Service has a long historical record in terms of heritage-related issues. To what extent are we moving more of our park personnel, the personnel basically on the ground, with individuals in the parks to understand the history of the area that they're in, maybe the archaeology, the geology of the area they're in, so that they're, in a sense, more on a National Park Service model?
Mr. Chair, thank you for asking that question. We are moving considerably in that direction. We have created positions across the state over the last 6 years. I don't want to say we haven't created new positions. We've reclassified folks or rearranged position descriptions to move folks into interpretation in our parks. And when we have instituted a training program for staff in how to interpret parks or interpret the history and how to make presentations and so forth, and we also include volunteers in that training program. So we have sort of a three-tiered level of training. You can become a basic interpreter, and after, you know, achieving a basic level of training and a blank training experience, you go to the next level, and then ultimately you become a master interpreter. So that's a program that we have underway, and we've done that with the resources that we have. We created in 98 a position on the staff as an interpretive coordinator, and so we have one staff person who has extensive interpretive experience as sort of managing our interpretive program. And we also do training, cultural resource training and historical preservation training within the department for not just our department but for other park and recreation providers as well. And we are also acquiring properties for historic purposes, such as Thompson's Mills and most recently the ghost town of Golden down by Wolf Creek. And we also participate in what's called the Pacific Northwest Field School, which is a program with the University of Oregon, Oregon State University, Washington State Parks, the National Park Service, and Idaho State Parks, where we use this as a training vehicle to train folks in historic preservation and interpretation. We've got a long way to go, but frankly, this is one of the areas in the department that I think we've made tremendous amount of progress in the last 5 or 6 years. There's a great interest on the part of staff, you know, to become involved as interpreters and do this kind of work, and I think we're headed in the right direction on that. But I share your vision with that.
I appreciate your comment.
We will go on to the next item, which is the. We'll go on to 6 and 7, and that'll leave us just a little bit of time for questions before we finish up today.
Item 6 is what Representative Dinkfelder was referring to earlier, but it's a measure of how the department is doing in acquiring acreage against the Oregon benchmark of 35 acres per of state park lands per 1,000 population. And what this indicates is that, you know, we're currently at 28.6 or 28.06 per 1,000, which is about 80% of the goal. But the goal of 35 acres per 1,000 compared to the national average, which is about 47,000 acres per 1,000, is still falls short. So we're fighting kind of two trends here. We're behind in terms of getting to the benchmark and certainly to the national average, but we're also we also have to fight the population trend. So for every 1,000 more people we have in population to meet this thing, we need another 35 acres. And so we're behind. We got to catch up with the population growth, and we also have to make up the difference in terms of getting to the 35 acres per 1,000. So it's a challenge.
Chair? Can we ask a question now, or do you want to wait?
You know, actually, Representative Garrard, because I think there are going to be a lot of questions about just this one. Maybe we will stop with this one and let people ask questions. So go ahead.
Kim, I have the same problem Representative Dinkfelder had. Here's per 1,000 population here. Here's the percent of the population that's using our parks. It seems to me that you should be dividing the 35 acres by the number of people who use the parks and not the general population. I'm just questioning the index. I don't see how it can be accurately applied.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, there are some issues. If you're just looking at acres per 1,000 people, is it the right 35 acres per 1,000 people, or the type of acreage that you're acquiring, does it meet a recreational need, or is it just acreage? But this goes back to Oregon Benchmark 90 is where this originally established. And so this is that Oregon Benchmark 90 is the only parks and recreation benchmark that we have monitored by the, I don't have to say this right, it's the only benchmark we have under the Oregon Progress Board program. So that's where this link goes to. And it is a common measure across state parks systems. So, I mean, we have something to compare it with as we compare it to other state park systems. But, it's an indicator. Would we ever be able to meet this, even if we had, you know, $212 million of our budget went to acquisition? I don't know that we would. I don't know that I've answered your question either.
I'm just not sure what value the information is on a mass population basis, rather than the percentage of the state's population that actually utilize our parks. Then I could see how much land do we have versus how many people that use that land. But by just randomly taking the total population, to me, appears to just what value is the number that I have is your 81%. That's my question. So.
Representative Garrard, I see your point, but I guess there's two different directions in this. One is I do know that for a whole lot of different things that you see being provided by states or even at the local level, there are national standards. There are national standards in libraries. There are national standards in city parks, and usually they're expressed as an acreage, well, for parks, as an acreage per 1,000. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't answer the reverse question, which is, or not the reverse, but sort of the other underlying question is, do you have adequate park facilities for the people that actually want to use the parks? And that's sort of a different question.
One question that I have, obviously at 35 acres per thousand, your per thousand is going to change in a sense. The population is going to increase. Sorry, Representative Clem. But what does a 1% increase per biennium equate to now? Because that looks like what your target is from, you know, each biennium to go up by 1%. 1% closer.
Mr. Chair, I believe I have those numbers. I believe that equates to about 1,200 acres per year.
Okay.
I believe. I'll check that.
Or 2,400 per biennium? Or?
I believe that's correct.
Okay. And Representative Clinton.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm sort of wondering, if the underlying premise that if you accept it, it really makes a lot of sense, is that the more people there are, the more park space there should be. And if there isn't, that means people probably won't go because it's too crowded. And because it's too crowded, they don't go. And if you accept as a given that's true, well, then it makes sense. You've got to keep the parks up with the people or else they won't use it. If that's not the only factor, then it is kind of an odd assessment.
Any additional questions? Yes.
What are the actual population projections that you're hearing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, we use the data from Portland State University. That's the data source that we use.
Is that the million or a million and a half in the next 20 years? Or?
Well, I can't remember.
It's a million in the metro area.
It's a million in the metro area. I can't remember if the year is 50, 30, or 50, 40. But the total state population, I think, is projected to grow by close to 2 million people.
Mr. Chair, where's that additional property coming from? It's coming from out of the metropolitan area.
Not necessarily, though, because we just have the newest park is actually Stubbs Stewart State Park, which is. Is that within the UGB or not? No, that's right outside the UGB.
It's not outside of.
Yeah.
That's in this park, but. And Metro passed a bond measure, well, the voters did, for $225 million.
That's an excellent point, Mr. Chair, which is, do we have a performance measure that essentially says, are the acreage occurring where population growth is expected to occur? Because that might be.
Well, we could get into all kinds of policy discussions
right.
Here. There would be people that would argue that you wouldn't have a Yosemite if you had it where the population.
I don't want to travel.
But since you don't care whether the population visits the park or not.
Yeah, Grand Canyon, Las Vegas should be next to Grand Canyon.
Otherwise, it's a city park or a county park, though, really. If you're trying to get it right by where they live and walk to the park, that's not really the purpose, is it?
Well, I think we could get into a lot of policy discussions here. One that I've debated a long time, and I won't debate here today, is that state parks, I believe, has a role in terms of providing parks for Oregonians and for people visiting the state. It is not a local park provider. It is not a city park provider.
I'd love to debate that with you, Senator.
The costs are too high.
I thought everything east of the Cascade was one big park.
No, we're going into a deep policy discussion.
Thank you, Bill, for further opening that door.
Well, on that happy note, Mr. Wood, we will see you back tomorrow morning. Are we going to go to our work session first, or?
Yes, we will.
Okay. So our work session will probably, I would guess, take no more than 10 to 15 minutes. And then we will continue on with the performance measures.
Mr. Chair, if I could introduce Bill Gregory, who's in the audience.
Yes.
Bill's the chair of our commission who's sitting in for our hearing. So.
I kind of actually thought he was a member of the commission because he looked like he was being very attentive back there. It was not a comment on the rest of the staff. He's not a member of the lobby.
and he didn't sit in the front. So I think...
maybe you should close the hearing while you're ahead.
Yes. Well, with that, we will see you back here tomorrow morning, and we have three more days with you, and I think we'll be able to stay on schedule. So.
Thank you.
Yeah, in a sense, not really. We are now...